Hello, I'm Mike Armstrong. This is number 0162, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0162. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Kent Stetson and Paul Stetson. They are brothers. They're also the authors of the online novel Meet Cove. How did they come up with the idea of releasing the book in chapters online?
Well, I began thinking of, you know, the great stories about Charles Dickens, one of the world's great, great novelists. Started, you know, publishing in the 19th century and did it weekly. A chapter, all the great books, Great Expectations, David Copperfield, all the great books was a chapter a week in various popular magazines. So I began thinking, well, why not?
NFL safety Brett Lockett talks about his foundation to help troubled youth.
We started with the football camp. We just wrapped that up this past June, going on the third year. We started with about 75 kids the first year. And this year, you know, we actually did a collaboration with Snoop Dogg. We combined his league with Looking Forward Foundation. We had over 250 kids this year. We had a bunch of sponsors from Coconut Water to Veggie Grill to Power Ice. I mean, we had a lot of people really support this cause this year, and it's just been growing exponentially, and I'm, you know, really, really proud of where it's gotten to since day one.
Stuart Nauman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nauman. On this edition of Book Banter, we go back 200 years with Four Wars of 1812 and two other books about that same conflict. So let's go with Andrew Jackson down the mighty Mississippi on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0162, was Mike Armstrong, a reporter on Global National. You can watch Global National Monday through Friday. Actually, you can watch it 7 days a week on the Global Television Network here in Canada. You could also check out their website at globalnational.com. And thank you very much, Mike, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? On a program, by the way, that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Hooters waitress in Pensacola, Florida, faces multiple charges after allegedly beating her boyfriend with his own prosthetic limb. Jadeon Faye Marie Hatfield, age 23, and Brandon Fleming, age 25, ended their relationship in February. The couple now has joint custody of their 2-year-old son and had previously agreed to exchange the boy every 2 weeks. Now, on August 27th, Hatfield and Fleming got into an argument, unrelated to their child, by the way, that ended with Hatfield threatening her ex. According to Fleming, this is a quote, "She sent me a text message that said, 'I'm going to be 6 feet under just like my mama.'" Ooh, that's cold. Anyway, later that night, Hatfield came to Fleming's home to pick up their son, but Fleming refused to let her in and called the police. While he was on the phone, Hatfield allegedly snatched the toddler out of a bedroom window. Fleming jumped out of the window and ran to Hatfield's car to take the boy back. When he opened the car door, two unidentified men, armed with a PVC pipe and a wooden shaft, grabbed him and held him down in the back seat. Hatfield also joined in the melee, pulling off Fleming's prosthetic limb and using it as a weapon. Is this something you really want your child to see, by the way? Because he's in the car. Anyway, Fleming lost his foot in an accident, by the way, when he was only 7 years old and has worn a prosthetic since then. Anyway, even with the prosthetic pulled off, Fleming was able to escape from the grips of his attackers. But then, he says, Hatfield whipped out a shotgun. Hatfield, who has a previous felony conviction, allegedly said she would shoot Fleming if he tried to stop her from taking their son. Then she and the two men drove away. Hatfield was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, battery, interfering with the custody of a minor, and possession of a weapon by a convicted felon. Apparently those Hatfields will fight with anybody, not just the McCoys, and they also can really hold a grudge. She ripped off his prosthetic limb, but when it comes to the courts, her freedom and getting custody of her child, I'm guessing she's the one that doesn't have a leg to stand on. Anyway, Eric Espino, a deputy with the Bexar County, Texas Sheriff's Department, was celebrating his 26th birthday at his home with other officers and a dispatcher. This is a quote from Detective Louis Antu. He said, "When you have alcohol involved, sometimes things transpire." Wow. Don't you want to get that on a whoopee cushion? By the way, what transpired is Espino picked up his shotgun, and for some reason, Antu says, Espino put his hand over the muzzle, and when he picked it up, it went off, shooting him in the hand. Antu notes that Internal Affairs is on the scene and will determine if any of the partiers violated any department rules. Wait a minute. You mean there's no rule against deputies shooting themselves? Well, this is Texas. And finally, this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Well, here's a story that should totally creep you out. A South Carolina woman recently discovered her convict ex-boyfriend, who she dumped 12 years ago, holed up in her attic, spying on her, surrounded by cups of his own waste. Ooh, that's like a really bad film, huh? The Rock Hill, South Carolina woman who identified herself only as Tracy told the Charlotte Observer she was sitting in her bedroom on her laptop and kept feeling that something just wasn't right. She heard strange noises and saw insulation falling from the ceiling. Tracy, who has children ranging from 3 to 20, sent her two oldest sons to investigate, but they found nothing. Then, at 2:30 a.m., nails in the ceiling fell to the floor. She called her nephew, who investigated the depths of the cluttered attic, only to find Tracy's ex-boyfriend asleep in a heating unit next to a vent, which he had rigged to spy on Tracy. Cops found several cups full of the man's feces and urine in the attic, where he'd been staying for 2 weeks. Ew. The only way into the attic was through a hallway where the children's bedrooms are. Even creepier. Tracy dumped the man 12 years prior before he faced a stint in jail for robbing a flower shop, but she never lost contact with him completely. He wrote her love letters from jail, which she ignored. He helped install new doors on her home a year ago. Okay, there's the problem right there. She shouldn't have let him install those new doors. That's just giving this wacko hope. But anyway. Soon after, he was convicted of stealing her truck. He'd just been released from jail for that theft when he started sleeping in her attic. Tracy changed her locks, but said her children are now afraid to sleep in the house. As I said, this is like a bad movie, but when you think about it, if you were told this was a bad movie or in a movie script, you might not just believe it, but it's all true. Ooh. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Meet Cove is the title of a new crime novel that is the first of a series written by two brothers, Kent Stetson, a Governor General Award-winning author, and his brother Paul, a retired RCMP staff sergeant. Their crime series is about to be launched online. Both of them are joining us now via Skype-to-Skype communications. Kent joins us from Montreal, and Paul is in Prince Edward Island. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I got to start off by asking, who's the older brother?
Paul is.
Older and wiser, yeah.
Okay. But Kent, you're the one who, as I mentioned, you're the award-winning author. So do you get to finally tell Paul what to do, or how does it work?
Well, it never worked in the, like, 64 years that I've known him. So I gave up on that a long time ago. And we've been kind of natural collaborators since we were, barefoot on the farm.
Okay. Now, the title, Meet Cove, tell us what that means, first of all.
Paul, over to you, Paul.
Well, it goes back to my experience, I believe, Anthony, that we tossed around this idea for years, and we came up with it. Meet Cove is a tiny village in Northern Cape Breton, and it was one of the first postings I had. It wasn't Meet Cove, but Meet Cove was in the 1st Detachment area, and I had experience there. So we talked about that, and we come up with some scenarios around that.
Okay. Now, you have a character in your book, Prince Edward Islander RCMP Sergeant Waldron. Waldron McKinnon, is that correct?
That's right.
And
that's right.
A.K.A. Gandhi? Where does the Gandhi come from?
Well, we grew up in a small farming community on PEI. I grew up in a farm. And there was a neighbor of ours named Gandhi McCollum. And there was some confusion over the word Indian in the neighborhood. So, you know, this is back in the 50s and 60s when political correctness was unheard of. And there was a certain amount of confusion around what race the Mahatma belonged to and what race Micmacs belonged to. So we kind of picked up on this, and it becomes kind of a fun element of the novel that Gandhi actually absorbed the nickname by this confused guy that he grew up with, who had his Indians confused, so to speak.
We also had a connection in Cape Breton. There was a Gandhi in that particular area, too. So we married the two of them together.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, this is the first in a series, and I understand you'll have unique names that are place names for each book. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're thinking naming each book after an Atlantic Canadian town. Like the next one we're thinking about is Plaster Rock in New Brunswick. And then after that, Cowhead in Newfoundland. They just seem like great names for crime novels. You know, they're hard and they're sharp, and they got a little bit of a dark mystery about them.
If this series takes off, have you given any thought to what it will do for these communities?
Well, no. Look what Anne of Green Gables did to PEI.
There you go. Now, you're also launching this in a unique way. You're launching this online, correct?
That's right. We're taking. There's a couple of notions here, like the digital domain essentially has really baffled publishers of all genres of books. It's changed the game entirely. So I began thinking of the great stories about Charles Dickens. The one of the world's great novelists, and in the started publishing in the 19th century and did it weekly, a chapter, all the great books, Great Expectations, David Copperfield, all the great books was a chapter a week in various popular magazines. So I began thinking, well, why not? We have certainly the scope and the spread. We can do it relatively simply. Actually, we're putting this up with essentially four people collaborating. Our web designer, Aaron Allen, has been doing extraordinary work. And it's being edited by a friend of ours named Don Druick. So, we've become a little tiny, not a publishing house, but a little publishing entity. As our 90-year-old mother says, all we need for this to happen with this project is for it to go viral.
Oh, as the saying goes, your mom would be a hep cat.
Well, she's fairly cool, and she also said you'll also need a YouTube video, won't you? And I looked at her and said, have we met? You're remarkable, but she's dead on. She's right. I mean, the spread of this could be enormous, and the writing doesn't suck, does it, Paul?
Oh, it's excellent.
Now, what's it like, and I'll ask this question to Paul, what's it like for you two guys to write together when you are geographically in two different locations, or do you get together to write?
Well, we're on the phone back and forth, we're on Skype, and we're on, of course, the internet, but we had time together. Kent vacations here, he calls it vacations, but he actually works all the time he's here, so we do our research and stuff like that together. So it's been a great. I'm only working part time, so I have half a day clear every day. So
now, as someone who is an RCMP officer and you're writing about an RCMP officer, the creative process of it. Like, for instance, if Kent comes up with an idea or a story, is it too far-fetched? Do you put the realism in the RCMP, or do you sometimes allow, a little creative license there?
Well, we try to keep it as close to reality as we can. But sometimes for the sake of the story, we do go over the edge a little bit. We do a lot of late night debates on these. And after 31 years with the RCMP, I kind of, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart. I don't want to really, you know, put it too far out.
Well, what are your friends, your fellow RCMP officers, who I'm sure you've worked with for years and years, what do they say about the idea of you collaborating on this series with your brother?
You know what? We haven't talked too much about it. I would think, no, there's probably only one I've talked to about it. So we'll see come Friday.
Okay. Now you're launching this online, so there will be obviously an E version. Will there also be a dead tree version?
Well, it's interesting. I think probably the way that publishing works now, yes, there probably will. It's difficult now for you know, a version of this made of atoms and put on a shelf. It's difficult for publishers now to actually commit to that, but. And there was some fear for a while that a process like this would actually undercut sales, but now people are seeing that this could be an enormous sales tool. So if we build up a certain over, you know, that we're letting this go at www.masterbookworks.com on Monday, and if we build up a base in the process of releasing a chapter, three chapters a week every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 a.m., we'll have a base of subscribers already interested in the book, and we'll have, you know, the name will be out there, and it's a real boost to a publication. So we'll probably at some point soon, and I've had interest from two possible publishers already, just let it play out like this and see what happens. We're in totally new territory here, which I find really exciting.
Tell us a little bit about the story itself. What is the plot of Meat Cove?
Well, it's a story is based on human trafficking. Essentially, that would be the theme, I guess. The plot revolves around Gandhi McKinnon, who's gone into retirement after some difficulties at his last posting, which was in Montreal. He's gone home to the family farm on Prince Edward Island. His wife has recently died. He's like all great. Detective or fiction or mystery characters, crime fiction characters, he has a flaw, like Sherlock Holmes had a flaw, you know, as did his namesake, Dr. House on television. But his flaw for him is that he's, first of all, he's lost his wife, he's lost his interest in work, he's had difficulty at work, he's also drinking too much and has a problem with painkillers. So essentially what happens is there are two young people abducted from a mall in Charlottetown, and Gandhi is dragged out of retirement, kicking and screaming, but finally takes over the case and throws his heart and soul back into it. So it's a kind of there's a redemptive element to the things, a bit of redemption for Gandhi in the whole piece.
And Ken, I was going to mention that one of the things that Gandhi has gone to, he's a little bit disappointed in the way the force is going now, too.
Right.
And I think that's a fair piece of it, too.
And tell me, Paul, does this case ring true in any way, shape, or form to anything you've seen or witnessed in your career?
It's a little bit and pieces, Anthony, of everything I've seen in my career. And we've kind of thrown it in the mix, and we will in the next couple of books as well. And they're not all my stories, but they're stories that happen around me.
Now, what is the writing process like for you guys? Because you say you plan to release this three times a week. I'm assuming, I'll go on the assumption that you guys have written the entire novel and are releasing it this way, as opposed to writing it as you go along.
That's right. But we're like, I just, for example, with this, the work we've done so far, and we've collaborated completely on character, story, and plot right from the beginning. I do the bulk of the composition itself. Paul has contributed some fabulous stuff too, but it has to be kind of filtered through one mind. But then the stuff that gets written goes back and forth between us really quickly. And today, for example, I sent the polished versions, final polish. They go up on the site. We give them to Aaron in Truro, Nova Scotia. He converts them to PDF, and we're done. So 7, 8, and 9 went up today. 10, 11, 12 will go up by, you know, we're doing it like that. So we're doing the final polish and popping them up.
Excellent. You may be onto something here, a wave of the future, a new way for people to enjoy a book online. The book, the first one, is called Meat Cove, a Sergeant Gandy McKinnon crime novel. And gentlemen, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. Again, the website is masterbookworks.com, correct?
That's right. And we'll be up and running on Monday morning, Monday the 24th.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Peter.
Kent Stetson and Paul Stetson, authors of Meat Cove. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0162, and you'll find links to their website where you'll see all the details on the online release of the novel.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to NFL safety Brett Lockett. Plus, we have another edition of Book Banter. Stuart Nullman will be in to review another tome. And, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. But right now, much more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Here on The Stuff File program, a show heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. An angry homeowner apparently had better aim than a Nevada golfer whose errant ball broke the window of a home that overlooks the course. Jeff Fleming, age 53, of Reno, is accused of opening fire with a shotgun on a golfing twosome, hitting one man who was treated at a hospital and released. Now, not that I'm condoning gun violence in any way, shape, or form, because I think there's just way too many people who have way too many guns to start with. But do you get the feeling that this isn't the first window that poor Jeff has had broken since he lives next to a golf course? Yeah, I think he's basically reaching the end of his rope with golf balls. Just a guess on my part. Just a guess. Anyway, a New York college student said he suffered a sprained neck when he was struck by a mattress that fell about 30 stories to the sidewalk. Jesse Scott Owen, age 18, said he was walking in the city at around 12:45 p.m. when the mattress fell from a building and hit him in the head. "This was the most absurd thing that ever happened to me," the King's College freshman said. He said the impact knocked him unconscious. "I woke up and people were putting me on the mattress," he said. "I asked where the mattress came from, and they said, 'You were knocked out by it.'" Witnesses said the mattress may have been carried by the winds from the rooftop spa of the Sete Wall Street. Owen was taken to New York downtown hospital with a sprained neck and a possible herniated disc. You know, I just enjoy the irony that he was hit by a mattress and then people just kind of gently picked him up and put him on the mattress. That's priceless. A busload of tourists returning from an excursion into a volcanic canyon in southern Iceland had an interesting situation. The bus driver was horrified to discover that one of the passengers was missing. He quickly called authorities, who set up a search. Now, even the other passengers chipped in, looking for the woman described as Asian, about 160 centimeters, in dark clothing, and speaks English well. Now, it wasn't until 3 p.m. when one of the passengers helping to look for the missing woman told police that she thought she was the subject of the search itself. You see, she had changed clothes during the hike. It was only then that the driver thought to count the passengers, and all were indeed present. The woman had no idea that she was missing, noted the police chief. You'd think someone would have had the decency to tell her she was missing. But then again, she was involved with the search. An unnamed woman in South Strabane, Pennsylvania, got a restraining order against her husband in what must be the start of a messy divorce. That night, she returned home and found him, a police officer says. There was some kind of exchange happening, and she says he punched her, which caused her to lose her breath. Her husband then took off with the contents of her underwear drawer. He then allegedly tossed it all, piece by piece, out of the window of his car as he drove, leaving it scattered in a line through town about a mile long. He returned to the home several more times, and police finally caught up with him and charged James Clutch, age 54, with assault and violation of a protection order. Well, you know, I think now he's going to be the one who's going to get it in the shorts. Now, I did mention that the woman was unnamed, so I guess she wants to remain unnamed, but their husband's name is James Clutch, so I would assume that would make her Mrs. Clutch, which, since he was arrested for assault, among other things, would make him a clutch hitter. Yeah. An update now on a story we told you about a while back. A Tokyo artist who cooked and served his own privates to diners can now face up to 2 years in prison. Mayo Sugiyama, age 23, has been charged with indecent exposure more than 2 months after the controversial meal. And how is it decent exposure? I mean, isn't flashing your own genitals while they're part of your body indecent exposure? If they're on a plate... Anyway, I don't know. Five diners paid about $250 for the bizarre dinner. After Mayo underwent elective genital removal surgery, his severed private parts were divided up and garnished with button mushrooms and Italian parsley. Now, Tokyo police say the self-described asexual, well, he certainly is now, and three people who helped him stage the event face charges. The Japan Daily Press reports that if convicted, Mayo could face up to 2 years in jail and a fine of $32,000. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the reasons you do put people in jail is to, you know, give them a sense of right and wrong and to encourage them not to repeat, to become a repeat offender and commit a similar crime. I get the impression that, considering what he did to himself, this is not exactly a crime he's going to commit again. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an unidentified mother of twins was photographed at the Thanksgiving Point Deli in Lehi, Utah in September, apparently toilet training her toddlers at a table. I couldn't make this up if I tried, and I've seen the video, and I can't get that image out of my head. Anyway, another patron witnessed the mother bringing in what at first glance looked like booster seats, but then the mom undid the kids' jumpsuits and placed them on the potties. A spokesperson for the deli, which is located about 10 miles south of Salt Lake City, said the incident was over by the time it was reported to her, but the witness put a photo on the internet, which was picked up by several TV stations, so that millions of people could disapprove of the mother's parenting. Now, I know this story isn't the deli's fault, but seriously, that eatery is now certainly off my list. And I put this story, because it was a story, a television news story that I had found online, and I put that story up on the Stuff File Facebook page, the group page, which, by the way, you can go and take a look at. And if you'd like to, feel free to go to the Stuff File and group page and join it if you're not already a member. You're more than welcome to do so. And people have been commenting on this edition that I put on the Stuff File page that, you know, this woman has some very bad parenting skills. But as I responded to some of those other comments, judging by the fact that she just brought these porta-potties with her two little kids and put them up on the table or on the chair next to the table to let them do their business. And by the way, they pulled the pants down. The kid was wearing like a one-piece jumpsuit. So the kid's sitting there basically naked with the pants around the knees sitting on this porta-potty. Since she did this, it's not a matter of bad parenting skills. This is a person who has entitlement issues. The fact that she thinks she can sit in a restaurant amongst a whole bunch of people and do this with her children goes much deeper than her parenting skills. This is a woman, for instance, if she had no kids, I wouldn't be surprised if this was the kind of woman who could sit next to you on a flight and start clipping her toenails while passengers around her are looking for protective goggles. That's this kind of woman. That's just my feeling. But anyway, let's move on to our next guest, shall we? Yeah. NFL safety Brett Lockett is a star athlete, successful businessman, recording artist, philanthropist, and a role model for young people. He has a nonprofit organization called the Looking Forward Foundation that encourages young people to stay out of trouble, finish school, and become productive members of society. Brett joins us on the line right now from Las Vegas. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Pete. How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I mentioned NFL safety. You were last with the New England Patriots. What is your current status vis-a-vis the NFL?
Right now, I'm a free agent. I've been waiting to hear a call from some teams. You know, my agent's been talking to a few different teams. I don't want to drop any names, but just kind of, you know, playing a waiting game.
Is that a difficult prospect? I mean, you see the season has started and you are on the sidelines for now. Is the waiting game a difficult one to play?
It is. Especially when you're watching guys that aren't, playing their part, on the team. That's probably the most frustrating part, but at the end of the day, you can't really control what anybody else does. All you can focus on is what you do. So that's exactly what I've been doing.
Now, you had some injuries you had to deal with. Is that all taken care of now?
Yes, everything's all taken care of. Had surgery this past December, and, I'm back in tip-top shape.
Is it difficult to stay in shape when you are not playing in the season?
Yes and no. I kind of turned it into a routine. You know, it's almost like brushing my teeth, getting up and working out is almost become second nature to me. So, it really isn't difficult for me.
I mentioned in the introduction, in addition to being an NFL player, a lot of things that you were doing, a businessman, recording artist, philanthropist, and I want to talk a little bit about your nonprofit organization, the Looking Forward Foundation. When do you find the time to do all of this?
Well, we as athletes, we have a lot of time, not a lot, but a few months, out of the off season to dedicate, whatever it is that we want to do, whether it's, family time or vacation time. And, I've just found time over the past, 3 years in the NFL to really dedicate it to the youth and, helping them develop as young adults and as children.
So when did you start, and tell us a little bit about the Looking Forward Foundation?
Well, we started 3 years ago. We started with the football camp. We just wrapped that up this past June, going on the third year. We started with about 75 kids the first year. And this year, we actually did a collaboration with Snoop Dogg. We combined his league with Looking Forward Foundation, and we had over 250 kids this year. We had a bunch of sponsors from Coconut Water to Veggie Grill to Power Ice. I mean, you name it. We had a lot of people really support this cause this year, and it's just been growing exponentially, and I'm, really, really proud of where it's gotten to since day one.
In putting together an organization like this, you're working with the kids. In the time that you've been doing this now, what do you feel is the biggest stumbling block that you have to get around in helping these kids?
The biggest thing with any organization is obviously funding and getting people to donate. That's usually where a lot of charity foundations, have issues with. But obviously, getting everybody to kind of hop on board with what you're doing, especially when it's helping, when it's coming together with different organizations. A lot of organizations are almost stingy in a sort of way, and it's really not about, the organization. It's about what the organization can do for whatever it's projected to, whether it's cancer, cerebral palsy, or whatever the case may be. So that's the important thing.
You consider yourself a role model for young people, and I know that there are two camps when it comes to that, as far as people in the public eye is concerned, be it athletes or people in the entertainment business. Some believe that the role you play in that, whatever career you're in, is also in addition to being a role model for younger people. And other people say, no, it's not, that my life is my own and my career is my own, and that parents and teachers should be role models. And obviously you feel you should be one. Give us your reason why.
I don't necessarily feel I should be a role model. I feel that, I'm an example. I'm an example of what you should and should not do to young kids and to anybody who's really watching. For me to say that I'm a role model when I'm not in somebody's life for, really an extended period of time, that doesn't really make sense. I really believe parents and, brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles are role models, especially to these children, because they are the ones that spend the most time. And believe it or not, kids are influenced by TV and everything else, but you really see how influenced they are by their parents.
Who were the role models for you?
My biggest role models were my parents growing up. My parents instilled a lot of creativity and a lot of passion when it comes to wanting to succeed and giving me that never quit attitude. So they've been a huge role in my life.
As I mentioned, you spent some time playing with the New England Patriots. I believe you spent 3 seasons there.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're hoping to move on to another team in the NFL this year. When a player moves, because a lot of players have philanthropic things that they do with organizations and groups such as yourself. When a player moves from one city to another, is that a difficult thing to do when it comes to organizations and charities that you work with?
Not really, because it actually helps you expand, because you're going from, one city to another, and, there's always different charities and different organizations in other cities who, would love to work and collaborate with whatever it is that you're doing and make it just that much bigger. So I actually think it's a positive instead of it being a negative.
As you mentioned, you work with keeping kids out of trouble, or helping to keep the kids out of trouble and finish school. Do you find sometimes in talking to the kids that there is, how can I say this, a lack of hope?
Sometimes. There have been some situations to where, kids have, come from tough backgrounds and hard economic struggles. And that is probably the hardest thing, is getting through to a kid who's, been abused or been, beaten or whatever the case may be. It's hard to get them to open up, but once you do, and once you're able to do that, it's really incredible and to see how happy they really are. But there's a shell that you have to break before you can even do that.
How has dealing with these kids affected you in any way, shape, or form?
It's just helped me become more humble, I want to say, and just helped me realize how important my upbringing was and how privileged I was to be able to be brought up in a middle class. I wasn't rich. We didn't grow up rich or anything like that, but we definitely didn't grow up poor, and I really didn't need for anything. So to grow up that way and see, you know, the kids, you know, in lower class homes and on welfare, the way they live and, you know, just how badly they just want to have fun and not be able to do that because of their financial circumstances. It really humbles me, and it really, you know, allows me to see the big picture.
You mentioned that you're looking at some NFL teams right now, and you can't mention which ones they are for obvious reasons, but do you have any ETA as to when we can expect to see you back on the field?
You know, to be honest with you, Pete, you know, it's one of those things to where it's all on everybody else. I mean, it could be tomorrow, it can be, you know, 2 weeks from now, it can be a month from now, but, you know, whenever I get that call, I'll definitely be ready.
Okay. I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, Brett. People can find more information, by the way, by checking out your website, which is brettlockett.com, and that's Brett with one T, Lockett with two Ts. I thank you very much, Brett, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
All right. Thank you, Pete, and thank you for having me.
NFL safety Brett Lockett. You can check out his website at brettlockett.com. That's Brett with one T, Lockett with two Ts. And, of course, you'll find a link to his website by going to my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Here's a lawsuit that was all about the tooth, the whole tooth, and nothing but the tooth. When convicted felon Jerry Flannery entered prison, he had only five teeth. 2 years later, he lost another tooth. He said it was because the prison didn't give him toothpaste, so he sued them. Prison officials said he had plenty of toothpaste and pointed to his long history of dental problems. A judge dismissed the case as frivolous, but Flannery appealed. Amazingly, he won the right to sue, and after 4 years of litigation, his case recently went to a jury. The verdict? Of course, the prison was not responsible. Let's be fair. Frivolous lawsuits by inmates are a big problem. Inmate lawsuits cost more than $80 million every year just to defend. It means that even if you are never sued, you'll still pay for lawsuit abuse as a taxpayer. Learn more about how we all pay for lawsuit abuse. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, Stuart Nolman is here, and it's time once again to do Battle Between the Pages. Hello, Stu.
Well, yeah. Well, hello, Peter. I'm just getting my musket all set. Well, let's see. Got the powder in. Got ball bearing. Just getting the... get all set. Put the ramrod back in this into the rifle. Get the flintlock ready. And fire. Okay, now I'll have to take another 10 minutes to set up again. How you doing, Peter?
I'm fine.
Well, that's the way warfare was 200 years ago, Peter.
Yes, yes.
And this edition of Bookbinder, we're going to commemorate that because a certain battle took place 200 years ago. Because what happened was the American Army invaded Canada for a second and final time in a conflict that erupted over constant interference by the British Royal Navy of American merchant ships and warships in order to practically Shanghai its sailors to join the Royal Navy, as well as interrupt American trade with Britain's longtime enemy, which was France.
I'm reminded of comedian John Rogers' line about why it's never a good idea for the Americans to invade Canada because we spread our cities out too far for them to find to anything. You go to the right, you go to the left, it's nothing but wilderness.
And maybe if you're lucky, one, you know, in a few days you may hit Winnipeg.
Exactly.
But that conflict, which was known as the War of 1812 and still is, has created many, many, many memorable moments and legendary figures, such as the Battle of Queenston Heights, the burning of the White House, the creation of the Star-Spangled Banner, Sir Isaac Brock, Laura Secord before the candy stores, and Tecumseh. However, the War of 1812 was not just restricted to the battlefields of the United States and Upper and Lower Canada. According to historian Peter D. Peter McLeod in his new book, Four Wars of 1812, it was fought on four separate fronts. Now, this book, Four Wars of 1812, which was produced in conjunction with the Canadian War Museum in Ottawa to coincide with an exhibition to commemorate the war's bicentennial, which runs until January of 2013, this book focuses on the four fronts: the American War, the British War, the Canadian War, and the Native American War. and through reader-friendly text and photos that includes rare artifacts from the Canadian War Museum's collection, including Isaac Brock's red military tunic that he wore to his death at Queenston Heights in 1812, McLeod does a fine job explaining every aspect that has made the War of 1812 significant to the history of the warring nations that participate in it.
Sir Isaac Brock wore that tunic at the time of his death?
Yes.
I hope they dry cleaned it.
Well, they did, but the wound is still there.
Ooh, ew.
Yeah, the bullet hole.
Ew, okay.
Or sorry, the musket ball hole, sorry. A couple of good examples that are outlined in this book is, for example, lawyer Francis Scott Key, when he wrote the lyrics to the Star-Spangled Banner, he did it while witnessing the bombardment of Fort McHenry in Maryland and wondered if the American fort was defeated until he saw the American flag still flying over the fort the morning after the attack. The song, originally a poem called Defense of Fort McHenry, was first performed to music in October of 1814, but not officially become the U.S. national anthem until 1931. And here's something. One of the most unusual items that emanated from the fiery, violent attack on the town of Niagara-on-the-Lake in 1813 was a book called Sermons on Several Subjects by the Right Reverend Beale B. Porteous.
Mm. Now, I got to ask, if bombs are flying all around,
yeah,
are you going to be sitting there casually writing a song?
I guess Francis Scott Key was a very gutsy guy.
I guess. Talk about a calm demeanor.
Yeah. Or maybe foolhardy. I don't know.
Yeah.
A little brave. I mean, don't forget, those ships were made out of wood.
Yeah.
You know, couldn't withstand such bombardments.
No.
Now, this book I was telling you about, the sermons on several subjects by the Right Reverend Beale B. Porteous.
Yes.
Now, this volume was borrowed from the local public library by an Anglican minister named Robert Addison. Now, however, Addison was arrested by American troops, and the book ended up overdue for 193 years.
Mm.
Think of the library fines. You know how many new books that you require with the library fines from that one book?
Yeah, exactly.
A lot.
Yeah.
So, Four Wars of 1812 is an informative companion volume that offers four viewpoints of the war that not only marked the final time Britain and the United States took up arms against each other, but also signified the end of the Napoleonic era, sowed the seeds of Canadian nationhood, and sadly began the tragic struggle of Native Americans to hold on to their homelands in the face of Western expansion across North America.
Don't tell me the ending. I want to find out who wins.
Okay, I won't. I won't ruin it for you.
Okay.
And above all, this war is a war that helped shape the modern face of two mighty continents. And if you believe it or not, if you want to read more about the War of 1812, there have been a lot of books that have been released to commemorate the bicentennial. There's a couple of books that I have to recommend for my favorite historian. Yes, that's Pierre Burton, who in 1980 and 1982 did a two-volume history called The Invasion of Canada and Flames Across the Border, which gives an excellent authoritative look at the War of 1812, the people who fought it, the leaders, and also some of the most devastating effects of the weapons that were used, especially one called grapeshot. And he's quite explicit on how, you know, this is more than just cannon fire. This had very devastating, damaging, deadly effect, you know, if you were in its line of fire. But if you can get the book separately, the publisher, Doubleday Canada, issued a companion volume which combines the two books in a single volume. So that's now available for $29.95 in large paperback.
Whoa. Oh, large paperback. Because I'm wondering, we always used to talk, you remember back in the day,
yeah,
when we did a review of a Pierre Burton book, we always did the drop test. And I'm thinking, yeah, how do you put two of his books into one? Because, you know, I always thought that the way Pierre Burton was going to die was,
yeah,
was under the weight of one of his own bookcases.
Well, who knows? He may have went that way. You know, he was trying to get a book, you know, or a volume to research or something like that. And all of a sudden, the weight of, you know, all of his books in one case, yeah, that could be deadly.
Because that man is probably the biggest enemy of Smokey the Bear. I mean, he killed a lot of trees.
But the pulp and paper industry have shrines to him.
Exactly.
Oh, yes. But he was a very interesting writer. And, you know, he did his research. What can I say?
Anyway, the book the book on the War of 1812, once again, is?
Four Wars of 1812 by D. Peter McLeod, published by Douglas and McIntyre. And it's $19.95 in trade paperback, but it's a slim and very easy to carry trade paperback.
Okay. And if people want to find you, Mr. Nolman, how can they do that?
Well, you don't have to go back to 1812, but you can read me in the West End Times in paper, like they used to do in 1812. But also, if you want to go to 2012, you can see me online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Peter. Now, shoulder arms, I must march with my troops. General Brock cannot wait any further.
Yeah, plus he's got that musket hole in his uniform. Someone needs to sew that up. Thank you, Stuart. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about in the home stretch with this edition of the Stuff File program. We have, of course, an Idiot of the Day coming up, but we have a couple more Stuff File stories to get to before we reach that point, including the Darwin File, because as you know, the Tree of Life is often self-pruning, and these two Darwin File cases certainly have ironic twists to them. The first one, five young men died in Ontario, California in September when their car rolled over as many as five times after speeding through a red light at 1:45 in the morning. One of the occupants had sent Twitter messages during the ride referring to being drunk, going 120 miles per hour, drifting corners, and daringly, in two messages, said YOLO, which is short for You Only Live Once. Yes, yes, you do. And the second one, which I got to admit, cold as it is, I couldn't stop laughing. A 47-year-old man was accidentally strangled in June in Eastern Cape Province of South Africa. He had taken to wearing his recently deceased dog's leash around his neck in remembrance, but bending over, got the leash caught into a car's axle as it drove away. Yeah, well, he's reunited with the dog again, I guess. You know, seriously, how do you give a eulogy for this last guy's funeral without laughing? It's like the Mary Tyler Moore episode of The Death of Chuckles the Clown. Anyway, moving right along. The next time your boss catches you browsing Facebook while you're on the job, tell them that you may be just helping solve a crime. After all, the Tazewell County Sheriff's Office used Facebook to track down a missing sex offender after his girlfriend liked the department's page on the social networking site. Dylan Nature, age 29, is a convicted sex offender in Maryland. He was allegedly hiding out with his girlfriend Samantha Dillo, age 22, in Virginia. We still don't know exactly what motivated Dillo, but for some reason she decided to like the local police department's Facebook page. Tazewell County Police then used the geographic stamp left by Dillo's like to pinpoint her residence. Nature was taken into custody and now faces charges in Virginia for failing to register as a sex offender. He could also face federal charges for crossing state lines. And if given internet access in jail, don't be surprised if one of his first activities is unfriending Dillo on Facebook. Dillo herself is also in trouble with the law, facing charges of obstruction of justice for harboring Nature. Now, this couple almost made it as the idiots of the day, but they didn't. After all, not everybody understands the far-reaching powers of Facebook, but the idiot of the day is coming up later. Okay, here's a story that certainly sounds like a joke, but it's true. The Chattanooga Times Free Press reported in July that vandals had wrecked the pen that reptile farmer David Driver employed to keep his herd of 1,600 turtles, and that they all fled. Okay, seriously? How far can 1,600 turtles get? And if the answer is far, then riddle me this, Batman. How long was it before someone realized that they were missing? Because, frankly, I'm thinking it had to be days. Also, can you picture being somewhere and seeing 1,600 turtles heading in your direction? That must look like one creepy, slow-motion horror film. And a 40-year-old man swiped a cell phone while visiting a patient at the Kigali Hospital in Uganda in August. The facility is currently treating the country's Ebola virus outbreak, and the phone was in the room of an Ebola patient. Doctors urged the thief to return to the hospital for treatment. Yeah, I was also tempted to make this story the idiot of the day, but that's just plain sad. Although, give it some time and it might make a reappearance later on as a Darwin File story. But this next story, well, that's the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Two Two robbers who walked into a 7-Eleven in Arlington, Virginia in August apparently neglected to coordinate in advance and thus left empty-handed. As the first man pulled a gun and demanded money, the second, a few steps behind, tossed a firecracker on the floor, apparently to intimidate the clerk. However, it mainly served to scare the gunman, who dropped his pistol and ran out the door. Now, fellas, coordinate your plan. I mean, why would you set off a firecracker behind the person you're robbing a store with? And as for the other guy, why are you robbing a store with a gun when clearly things that go bang freak you out? One reason, and one reason only for both of these guys. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0162. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0162. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.